794 Sorda, August 16, 2009, Lecture 5.3, Final Review Continued. Okay. So, do you have questions you want to review a little more?
It's not so much a exam question as it seems like a lot of the reviews out there are partial. They cover some of what you want, but not all of it. Is there a good technique for when you compare one review against another for looking at more than just completeness? I guess what I'm trying to figure out is sometimes when you're trying to select software to investigate further, you're doing your initial study
right. And
your initial survey, you may not find a lot of information on one of the applications, or you find just enough to kind of tease you. And so is there any way of, looking at the gaps between the different reviews and adjusting for that?
If you have three reviews on the same piece of software that, well, one review doesn't cover everything, maybe among the three they do. But I think your question is, I have five pieces of software which I want to choose from,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't able to find but one or two reviews for each,
mm-hmm.
and for one piece of software of the same kind, they tell me about the interface, and for the other, they tell me more what they can do, and so I can't really compare one.
That's exactly my question. Thank you.
The only way to get at that is maybe you find out more information, and maybe you do a more targeted Google search with that software name in the particular app that you're interested in, or you need to get a demo version and look particularly at those pieces that were not reviewed. If you have something thoroughly reviewed about X, then you may not need to spend time examining the demo version for that. But if it's not about, now why it's not, then you might spend time to review that one. And that's just a common sense. I don't think there's no way to get information or divine information you don't have. That's what it boils down to. But it's something that's sort of useful to watch out for. It's useful to watch out for, and think of any review as resolved, is the review complete?
Mm-hmm. Is there one particular aspect that's very frequently left out in reviews? Like, do they normally cover usability and a couple features, or do they normally neglect usability entirely?
They normally do cover usability.
Okay.
They may cover one feature but not the other. And so if the other feature is the one that's of key importance to you, then that review is not too helpful. They may not cover the market share of this product,
mm-hmm.
which is something that might be available from elsewhere. I guess two of you were fortunate enough to have access to the Gartner reports. They will give you at least that piece of information.
Mm-hmm. Not really. But,
not really?
You can usually find it online. If there is a major company whose name shows up in a Gartner report, the company can pay, and then Gartner will make that available free of charge.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And that way the company gets more exposure, and Gartner gets money, and the company gets its name out there, and its reputation gets boosted.
But market share is often accessible. I mean, you could just use it. If you put content management system market share, might you get a site that gives you the market share of the different companies? I wouldn't find it unlikely, actually, if that's what you're interested in.
No, but it just means that the Gartner report may be available even if you don't really have access to it.
But there are other people who do market share.
Yeah.
There are other people who do market share.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just the Gartner report.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I think I mentioned that if you want comparative reviews, it's often a good idea to just do a Google search and put in three names of three software packages, and you find articles that have all three of them in. Okay, anything else you want to ask about specifically? I'm going to spend a few minutes to just look over that outline and see if there's anything. I mean, that is a review in itself. Having a
software collection policy? Is that something that we should be concerned about?
Where did they talk about? Oh, this is still looking at earlier notes. I think this is something you should be aware of, and we talked about a software library, and some people do have software libraries.
Mm-hmm.
They collect. And so if you were to design a website for for educators to find software there's a website that has all database management systems. So some of them may be selective. So it's a collection, even though they're not physically there, how do they decide to put some pieces of software into their collection or not? A school system, of course, may have they have a collection of software. They may not have a software library, but the collection is all the pieces of software used in that school system. And they will have a policy on what can be used. The teacher cannot just use anything they want to, just like textbooks are adopted or not. So how do they write an adoption policy for this collection of software in a school system?
Mm-hmm.
A large company may have, I mean, they may or may not have a centralized process of software acquisition, but they might. In any event, they have a software library, whether known by that name or not, namely all the software that's used in that company is their software library. Now,
okay.
Do they have
do
they have a policy for that? Maybe they don't. Maybe everybody buys whatever they want to and uses whatever they want to, and nobody knows. Then it's an unorganized collection. Or they at least have an inventory, a catalog of that. Or one step further, they may have a policy that software can be bought only through IT, and maybe even can be installed only by IT on company computers. And people more and more do that for security reasons. And then they will have some policy what's acceptable software, what's not.
Yeah, we mainly discuss that in the context of large organizations and enterprise architecture.
You wouldn't find this like in a very small organization. I mean, if there's three people in the organization, they don't have it. But for a lot of organizations, it becomes a problem. And the policy may be that this has to be tested by the IT people for safety, for compatibility with other things that run on the machines. And somebody installing a piece of software on their machine that's networked may expose the whole company to a security risk. Right? So what sort of efficiency and effectiveness of the software used per se didn't accomplish that you'd have some sense of control. Security risks did.
Okay. What would be the criteria for like a one of those educational, like a website listing all of the educational mathematics programs available for K-12 education? What sort of things would they look at that policy of whether or not to include it?
They may have usability criteria. They may have a bias against drilling practice. I mean, if it is, it may be a site that whose expressive purpose is to make people aware of software that supports what's called constructivist learning, which involves the students more. So the extreme of constructivism is a student will learn only what they discover for themselves. If you take that principle to the extreme, then everybody has to start from scratch, and whatever happened before in the history of mankind couldn't be used, right? So obviously in the extreme it doesn't work, but related to that would be something like discovery method in science. So I'm going a little bit by example, because you have to understand what the selection criteria would be, which is you do your experiment and you discover laws of nature that way. Now, you cannot discover, I mean, a student in their lifetime cannot recreate all of science, but having done some of that discovery will make them better understand when they read about science and learn from what other people have done. Okay, so let's assume this website has the purpose of supporting, or spreading software that supports that kind of learning. But then you have a criterion. One of the big criteria will be, does this software engage the student in thinking and independent discovery? So to sort of coach the student to discover, rather than using the Nuremberg model of education, where it's a funnel by which you pour knowledge into students' brains. And so that's what you would find there. And of course, then on top of that, they would look at usability and whether the content is indeed correct in the sense that they have. I mean, if they guide the students to do experiments, are the experiments well chosen to be. Then the website may guide the student to do real experiments in what the biologists call the wet lab, with real things. And so if this is done, say, if this is a program that purports to support this in the home, then you would look at the quality of the experiments and how easily they can be done at home. And if the student does them reasonably correctly, will it actually get to the a good discovery? Because if the materials are not, I mean, if it's a problem that cannot be dealt with by things you have around the home and that needs more sophisticated scientific apparatus, then it would not be a suitable experiment. So there are pedagogical criteria whereby they would evaluate. Of course, a company may have a number of criteria whereby they will evaluate software that could be acquired on their computer, security being sort of a constraint. But actually, you know, if some piece of software is really needed by somebody and it's not secure, they could just get a computer that's off the network. So there are always ways to get around things. But if there are three pieces of software available that are equal quality and two are secure and one is not, sort of get the secure one. That would be a company, tell our company policy how to acquire software. And the policy may have criteria and a process. And the process may say, if some employee requests a piece of specialized software they need, somebody in IT or whoever is the software acquisition responsible will do some search and find out what else is available. And if there are other more available that seem better, we'll get back to the employee and talk to them. And in fact, the employee may in the end be happier. And they're not specialists in acquiring good software. They just happen to see this and it serves their purpose. They don't know that there's something else that serves their purpose better, or that would serve the purpose of five other people as well. And that would be positive.
I'm going to cover the final exam review questions 3 and 4.
We can.
Well, 3.
Actually, 3 would be useful. All right. So let's review number 3. Actually, there are 3 distinct questions here, related but distinctly answerable. What is the purpose of usability characteristics, of usability heuristics? Without usability heuristics, what do you have to do to find out whether a piece of software is usable by the intended users?
You have to test it against certain parameters.
You have to test it with real users. You have to do it real. It's expensive. And that's the only way you can find out whether it's usable, right? So how do usability heuristics help with that?
To eliminate certain obvious
if you examine the usability heuristics and the software fares well on each of them, ideally you could be able to conclude from that indeed if I were to do a test on this, the software would come out well. And if the usability heuristics are not met, then you would say, well, I would predict from that that it would not do well.
Is it always the case?
That's the purpose. The purpose is to assess the usability by doing a valid assessment of usability of a piece of software without having to go to user test case. Now, it may not be you may not debate user testing completely because there may be specifics that are not covered by the usability heuristics. But ideally, so in the ideal case, that's the problem. Okay. So that leads to the next question. How do you know this actually works?
You can see if they align to findings in the research papers and that sort of thing.
Yes, I think you're along the right track. But let's assume we don't have any publications, and let's assume I do 100 software evaluations a year, and I have this set of usability heuristics that I've dreamt up. What study can I do to find out whether these really work?
You can take out some historical data of the heuristics that you've done and the softwares you've already implemented based on those heuristics and see if the software is doing what it was supposed to.
Well, you could actually do this backwards. Yeah, I was going to do it forward, but you could do it backwards. You could say, "All right, I previously tested with users those 5 pieces of software. Let me see how they do. And actually, I tested those 5 that I'm now using, and for each of them I tested 2 others that I'm not using that didn't come out as well. So, to be independent, I will find someone who is small enough to assess these on usability heuristics, and I will let him do all 15 programs. And actually, what would be even better than have one person do that? You could have one person applying your usability heuristics against all these 15 pieces of software. You could have a second person do it too. Or maybe a third. Because then you could first of all figure out whether they come up with the same results. Because if they are not, then the heuristics are not useful. See, if they don't give reasonably consistent results, they are they're not useful. I think my brain for the right name is not consistency. There's a term of technical which will occur to me in a minute. For measurements which these all
metrics
being consistent. So when you apply a test different times, the results will be the same. So here we, in a sense, apply a test against the usability heuristics. And we do it 3 times by 3 different people. And if the results are consistent, then we at least know that the measurement is in some way reliable.
Repeatable? And
what?
Repeatability?
No, it's not. It will come to me in a minute. But the concept is clear. If the measurement is not reliable or consistent, then there can be no predictive value in the usability heuristic measurement, right? Because if one does that and that does that, how can it predict from something that's But then the next question, so assume we were successful in the first one, we had 3 people assess it and they came up with approximately the same result for each piece of software. Then we can check whether the software we rejected based on usability testing failed poorly on the usability heuristics, and the software we accepted for the development usability test did well. So then that would indicate that usability heuristics give me a good prediction of what does well in actual usability testing and what does not. So that's how I would know that a given list of usability heuristics actually is useful. Yeah?
I would have taken, a slightly different approach. If you don't have those kind of resources available, if you apply those heuristics and you have a program that meets all of those and is fine from that, and then you do an actual user test and the user does not give you any additional input?
I was going to do that first. I was going to say, let's apply this to several programs of different quality and then do usability evaluation of these programs, but forward. But then you still have to do the evaluation. Mm-hmm. If you already have data on usability, then you can...
Right, but if you don't...
If you don't, then you have to do... Now, presumably, if somebody publishes usability heuristics, and that goes back to what you said before, if somebody else did those tests, so if there is data in the literature that shows that good performance on the usability heuristic assessments correlates with good performance in actual usability testing that's useful, then we assume the usability heuristics are good. If not, then we assume that then we assume that they're not. So then, what about the third part of that question? I think when Nielsen first had a list of 7, then he had a list of 10, and not all of the 7 showed up in the 10. Even so, when you read them, they all make sense.
I think, like Dennis had shown us in the presentation, that you would arrange the requirements, your requirements of a particular software by priority, and then based on the priority, you would check.
No, but that's a different question. His requirements were all about functionality,
mm-hmm.
not about usability.
Oh. I see what it's.
Yeah. So here we just want to know if I want a list of 10 software characteristics that relate to usability that I can determine without user testing. I mean, the heuristic has to be determinable without user testing, just by looking, right? Otherwise, it's not a heuristic. So if I want to develop a list of 10, I have nothing. I want to be able to. How do I do it?
Since I probably will be doing this in the very near future, for my job, one thing that I plan to do is talk to the QC people, the testers, and individually talk with them and see what their biggest gripes are. And hopefully kind of table those and see, okay, these 6 have been mentioned by 3 people and these 7 have been mentioned by 2 people, and kind of see where those overlap.
All right, so this would be the first sort of brainstorming step of finding heuristic principal candidates. So you could just conjure them up from your head.
You
could look at the books. You could, but actually, let's say there are other books. So let's say it's tabula rasa. So it says it's a blank slate. We don't know anything. So we could ask users. We could. So when we're getting a list of things, we may need to do some sort of observational studies, even to get the list of things, but it would be just 2 or 3 users looking through various pieces of software and see what the problems are, to then the loan is okay. So we have a list of 20 candidates. How do we know which ones are the best 10? That's a research question. That is, it's like any kind of research where you want to use certain variables to predict something else. So, for example, in college admissions, you want to look at variables to predict success in college. Well, in graduate admissions, I think we used to require here the GPA and GRE. Okay. So, so as an analogon to this one, this other question may be a little easier for you to think about. So, we want to know whether we should require both of those, or if we require only one, so if our list is restricted to the length of one, which one should we require? What kind of study or data analysis would you do to answer that question? Still, you would need some set of data that you have both GPA and GRE. The students, right? You couldn't do it. And you would need to know college success for all those students. Okay, then what would you do?
And the success criteria?
The success criteria is,
for instance, did they graduate?
Did they, well, actually,
or
we could do it, did they graduate or not? Or we could get the graduate GPA,
okay,
to a quantitative prediction.
For a more quantitative,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. So then what do we do? We have 300 students. For each of them, we have GPA, GRE, and qualitative GPA on the graduate.
Probably do some statistical analysis.
Right. So we do a correlation between undergraduate GPA and graduate GPA. And then what do we do? We do the same for GRE. And we see which one is more highly correlated with the graduate GPA, if at all. There may be no correlation, in which case, but actually we are not, I mean, this is if you admit to really do the study well, you would have to admit a trial group of students, undergraduates, regardless of their undergraduate GPA. See, most graduate programs admit only students with an undergraduate GPA of 3.0 or above. So it might well, so it's possible that once you're 3.0, it doesn't matter if you're 3.0 or 3.5 or 4.0 undergraduate, but that the GPA with a 2 undergraduate would fail college most of the time. So if we really want to do it right. Now, we do admit some provisional students which have a lower GPA, so we get some of that data. So we do GPA, and then we would need to do the same thing for GRE. And see, we have the correlation higher. And whatever has a higher correlation would be the single one we use, if we use only one. So how could we answer the question whether we should use two rather than just one? Well, there's statistical analysis where you can say, okay, I'm going to use the GPA to predict the, use undergraduate GPA to predict the graduate GPA. And now I measure the additional prediction I could get by also considering GRE. Not GRE alone, but it's considered, it's a partial correlation. So it's a method to compute a correlation between GRE and Gallo GPA, but sort of breaking the students down into groups with same GPA. So for the GPA from 3, between 3 and 3.25, what's the correlation between GRE and for the students between, that would give you the additional information. See, it may well be that within each group of intervals of GPAs, knowing the GRE adds nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no further prediction. But it may also be that it has a big prediction. So you don't know. So maybe with the GPA alone, you are 60% correct in predicting Gallo GPA. And by using the combination, you are 85% correct, in which case it would be useful to use GRE. But maybe the combination you are no better, in which case knowing that undergraduate GPA is enough and knowing the GRE also would give you no additional information. I don't believe it's so. I mean, I actually, my hunch is that the GRE is probably valid predictor. And the reason I have this hunch is that when students do poorly in my core course, I often check the record. And in the times when we still had GREs, maybe 20 students over time, one of them had a good GRE. All the other students who did poorly in that course, I mean, I just want to look why did they do poorly, so a little bit below a B, they all had very poor GREs. But the GPAs were not necessarily that poor. They might not have been from a good college, but they were still at a reasonably key. So, how do we apply this idea to, we have 20 candidates for heuristics. How do we apply this to select a set of 10?
One thing I'm stumbling on with this is for the metaphor of graduate GPA success,
right.
We have a very clear success criterion. The graduate level GPA is what you are measuring.
Right.
It seems harder to measure success or failure of software, especially quantitatively.
Well, you would have to have a usability study with real users, which puts out a single score of usability, or which puts out 5 subscores of usability. You know, in the intelligence quotient, they have a single score, but they also have subscores that
right.
make up.
But that's not so much measuring how good or bad the usability of the software is for your purposes. It's measuring it against the standards that another organization or lab or whatever has
well,
already
it,
set. I mean, it's helpful, but...
You can do the test yourself and make it for your purposes and score usability for your purposes. But to really figure this out on a scientific basis, I mean, you can do it just intuitively. But to really get it on a scientific basis, you would, and let's do for simplicity, let's assume we have a single score of usability. We could run and let's also assume that for any subset of the 10 usability heuristics, we could compute a total score of predicted usability. Well, actually, that's not, I mean, a score on how well it fares on heuristic. And so that would give it actually many different heuristic scores because there are many subsets of 10 out of 20. But it would be fairly easy to run a correlation for each of those, assuming you did this for 10 pieces of software, because otherwise you don't have statistics to compute with. And then you could determine which subset of 10 usability heuristics out of the 20 candidates is best correlated with the usability score, let's say, found out, that came from the testing. So if you have different aspects of usability, and so you have subscores, then you could see which group of usability heuristics best predicts that subscore. That's a statistical analysis at that point. Now, as you remember, this whole thing is entirely more complicated because usability depends on how much you learned. So there's learnability, and some of the usability heuristics may be correlated with learnability. There's also usability after you learned it. And that may be less strongly correlated to some of these usability heuristics because you sort of train people. And through the training, some of the things that were hard to use without training are now easy to use. So it's a very idealized environment, the testing aspect, but that would be the way to do it in the abstract anyway. In real life, you might have to do it a little more sense. But always there needs to be some empirical basis for saying this particular characteristic of a program is a good predictor of usability, or at least some aspects thereof. And people may have done studies individually, and they may have said, well, if we take this characteristic of the program, how is that correlated with learnability? So you could use existing studies.
Mm-hmm. The author of this book, Nielsen, has some of those studies available for purchase.
Right.
Where he actually has done that.
Right.
But he also, I guess the problem is how you structure the surveys or how you interview the users and figure out those success criteria could potentially completely bias the results. Like if you specifically ask the users, were the menus and windows organized very logically?
That's not what I would mean by usability test. Usability test, I would mean you have the user doing tasks.
Okay. And not surveys, but actual observations.
No, yes, and you look at time used and errors made and so forth. And yeah, I mean, you could still ask users too, but to think about it, but I would actually, when they actually use the program,
okay,
how well do they use it? And there's a bunch of Nielsen's book on how to do that. Well, maybe we should do some brainstorming in question four. What are important ideas you have learned in this course? Don't be shy.
Yeah, one is that usability is not just sort of a gut feeling, that, you know, it is sort of an empirical process.
Okay.
And the importance of going through the elaborate process of evaluating software. What's the first step to get it right?
Right. Always commensurate with the importance of the software in the organization, and the wide span of its use, and so forth.
Use of graphics is not does not actually mean that the website is more usable. Just by using graphics, that the two terms are usually associated with each other.
Graphics should very distinctly be used to serve a purpose. And then it might be very useful.
Yeah.
But if it's just thrown in there for makes a website more attractive, it's usually distracting.
Yeah.
It sometimes is better to add more description. So instead of saying open and having a button labeled open, you have it open file, where you add a few more words, and that can make a lot of difference to the usability versus if you just have a more high-level concept.
Labeling should be understandable by users.
Yeah.
It's a good principle. And again, applies to software interfaces and websites equally.
It's nice to look at Nielsen's book and some of the quantitative methods and when a user really gets frustrated and how long that takes.
Okay.
Yeah, page 135 in the response time. And another important idea that I learned and immediately applied was on doing user surveys.
Okay.
And the Likert scale and how to very strongly make questions very biased so that the users will give more honest answers.
Sometimes that's good.
Or polarized. That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah. It may not always be the best.
Highly polarized questions when doing user surveys.
Okay. That may be good sometimes, but not necessarily always.
No, not always. But I actually applied that like a week after I read that.
Okay. And it worked?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good answers.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed learning about the personal information management.
Okay.
Part.
So learning about various kinds of software. That usability has many dimensions, I think, is important. When the Nielsen had a diagram and the learnability, and this the idea that sometimes learning is worthwhile. You can't always expect this to be. The problem that needs no learning beforehand is often much more expensive in use over time. Because the use of shortcuts is one of the examples of this. And I think there was some studies that Windows was first introduced as opposed to just keyboard-based interface. People were much slower in doing things. Of course, some of it was a learning effect. I mean, they had to first learn Windows. But the alpha, and I think a lot of people today work more slowly than they would if they had to, if they would in pre-Windows days. Because they just use mouse and keyboard, mouse and clicking. And to do a mouse click for every copy and a mouse for every paste you do, it's just not a selecting a print by clicking. It's just not fast. Which is why people have shortcut keys. So it's the thing, it all gets to the things we know with an expert uses. And that a usable interface needs to be usable by both most efficiently. And that the interface for novice users is rarely most efficient for expert users. And that there should be a way in the interface itself that easily transitions people from one to the other. What would be a mechanism to easily transition a person from clicking mouse to using shortcut keys? How can you teach them the shortcut keys as they still use the mouse click interface?
Well, you can display it sort of in the menu.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, hopefully people will encounter that enough times.
Yeah, it's a simple principle, but not all people do it. And if you do it, make sure the shortcut key works while the menu is displayed.
Mm-hmm.
Because in some systems it doesn't work. Because it's not intuitive.
I learned the importance of looking at the output of the software.
Okay.
So like on the midterm, the decision support tools, word processing tools, looking at the documents and not just how people use it.
Okay.
Looking at the products produced by the software is important.
So you could generalize this to examine the actual task the user has to do. So, I mean, the word processing software example that you could, to find out what kind of software you need to look at the types of documents that the organization produces. Lawyers, just to the extreme, example is lawyers, where often 90% of the documents consist of boilerplate. So you need an easy way to include boilerplate. Actually, document management system will help there. But they also have sort of a standard format. So you need an easy way to produce that standard format. If this company has five different documents that are all sort of follow their own standard format, to have something like templates is important. If the documents are all without much formal structure, templates is also important. So they're just all examples. You have to look at the task users are doing. That's why when you did the project, one of the steps was to actually describe what kind of work the software is supposed to support. It's always hard for students to do that. And I often have to go back and say, you said what the software does, but you didn't really say what the user of the software is supposed to accomplish and what their mental processes are. So that you can then say, how does the software support that? That's an important idea. There's a similar, this is really the same principle in studying user requirements for a library. You can't just study the questions people ask. You have to study the problems people have to solve, the tasks people have to accomplish, and then analyze what information is needed to accomplish those tasks. And the users often don't know all the information that would be helpful to them, because they don't know it's available. So it's the same principle. It's the users are not designers. They may not even understand their own task that well. And so when you interview them, you actually help them understand what they're doing. And you will get a good understanding of the problem, and then inside that piece you can then do requirements for software. Other important ideas you have learned? Other questions you have?
I have a question about the final evaluation package. And if are you looking for our presentation to be turned into more of a paper format, or can it exist as a PowerPoint presentation?
I think we're looking for a paper form that somebody could read through. Now, you may you could do that as a PowerPoint presentation with notes.
Okay.
I'm just thinking about that. That would be, because that would be, I mean, as long as somebody can read this,
right,
and get a sense of what this software does well and not so well, or what the critique is, and that would be okay. And let me, can that be easily exported in some readable format?
Yeah, but you can I can print that to PDF, and then so you have the slide and then the note on the bottom.
Right. I would like to, if you could send me fairly soon your final slides,
okay,
ahead of the paper, that would be useful. Yeah, and don't forget the 3 to 5 page reflective essay.
Mm-hmm. That is due on Wednesday. The essay is due on Wednesday.
If you send it electronically, I can have it later than that. But if you want to submit it on paper, I'll have it by Wednesday.
And the final evaluation package should then include all our previous work too, including
yes, just the whole thing. Oh, actually, I'm just remembering, I will be here on next Saturday. I have to pick up some things. Originally, I said Wednesday, I was not expecting to be here on Saturday, but actually, I'm going to be here to A, assemble some stuff in the Kinko's, and B, pick up some stuff from my office I have to take. So I will be here on Saturday, so a week from now, probably, at least until 4.
And you could submit an electronic version of our take home as well, right?
Yes.
Will you be able to provide feedback on our project and such if we get that to you, say, either today or Monday?
I'll provide some feedback regardless of when it comes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Will the final exam for the midterm, you gave a couple sample good responses. Will we also have that for the final?
Let me check. I don't know whether I have an answer sheet that easily.
Okay.
I want to find
it. Would be nice to.
Right.
Yeah.
In terms of the final package, trying to see if it sort of enumerates the different deliverables that are part of that. Presentation.
I may have done the brainstorming business a little more systematically last summer. So there are some notes from several. In general, there are earlier brainstorming sessions, and I don't think I sent these around. Okay, I'm going to have to take the whole. Okay, we have one more. Okay. I also emailed that to you as a real document, but it's easier to read. Okay, well, I think then we came to the end. Anyway, so good luck with finishing up all the pieces, and I guess the summer will be almost over by the time you, at least the academic summer, by the time you're done with that.
I'll be done with my graduation.
Okay. Actually, don't worry about the timing, though, because they don't send you a diploma until quite some time after. So I'd better mitigate before the end of August. That will be fine.
I'm glad I took this class, even though it was crazy to summer schedule.
Yeah. No, actually, you took the class, so I'm probably not going to do this here anymore, but is this three-weekend schedule convenient, or is it not convenient? Is it better to just do it two evenings a week?
It might have been helpful to space it out more. Because you have, I mean, right now it's every other weekend.
Yeah.
And it might have been helpful to have it be more of an extended, I don't know if it's like a 9 week.
Right. Well, David.
Yes. I'll be in one summer session because we're doing.